Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, this is Fran Lewis, reviewer, educator, reading and writing staff developer, interviewer, and talk show host, and I am totally excited. This is going to be an absolutely amazing show. I am going to introduce the author in just a minute, but let me just tell you, it didn't snow last night. It's beautiful outside, and the sun is shining, and the phones are working, and we are just so thrilled. So let me first say hello to Bethany. Hi, Bethany. How you doing?
Hi, Fran.
How you doing? This is going to be so much fun. And I want to introduce New York Times bestselling author, one of my favorite authors in the whole world, the author of over 57 New York Times bestsellers, including, I'm going to read it, White Hot, Hello Darkness, The Crush, Envy, The Switch, The Alibi, Unspeakable, Fat Tuesday, Smokescreen, and the book that we're going to be talking about, her new bestseller, and it better be number one soon, because if you didn't get it on Amazon, I don't know what's wrong with you, Low Pressure. And I read it in what Fran calls zap time, which means once I started it, I couldn't put it down. I would like to welcome to the show Sandra Brown. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, Fran. How are you?
Oh, I'm just so happy that you're here. You have
well,
no
thank you.
Idea.
It's my pleasure to be on your show. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're so welcome, and I'm so happy that your publicist was able to do this. So tell us a little bit about Low Pressure, what you want to tell fans. By the way, everybody, we're not going to tell a lot, because in order for you to learn more about it, you have to read it. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm reluctant to give away plot points. The story came about when they were having all of those terrible tornadoes in the South, in Tuscaloosa and Joplin, Missouri last year. And I was seeing, as a lot of people in America were watching the news and seeing all of these pictures of the devastation. And it was just mind-boggling to me that, you know, a force of nature could be that destructive. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this year we've had mm-hmm. equally destructive forces of nature. But mm-hmm. I was struck by that. And it occurred to me when I saw how these buildings had been demolished, I mean, huge buildings and cars trailer trucks thrown up in the air and flipped around. And I thought, how in the world did anyone survive that? And it got me to thinking that as they were pulling casualties from all the wreckage, it occurred to me, what would happen if they discovered later that one of the people did not die from storm damage, but had actually been murdered just moments before the tornado struck? The tornado would have virtually destroyed the crime scene. There would be very little for the authorities to go on in terms of gathering evidence. So to say that a crime scene would have been compromised would have been putting it mildly. It would have been totally demolished. So that's where I got the idea for Low Pressure. And I started working backward, you know, from there, and then built the rest of the plot around that premise.
Yeah, that was exciting. I said, oh, my God, that is really, I mean, after having Hurricane Sandy and some of the earthquakes in Japan and the other countries and the tsunamis, my God.
Yeah, I mean, you see what would happen. And I had actually, when I was a little girl, actually witnessed a tornado. Of course, in Texas, we see funnel clouds with some frequency. But I'd actually witnessed a tornado and lived through one when I was about 5 years old. And I recall being scared because my mother was scared. And I was picking up, you know, her fear. And I remember she and my little sister and I, you know, were in our house and the tornado came over. It didn't touch down. But it did strike the building where my dad worked and did considerable damage. And he and some of the other employees had gone down into the basement of the building, and that's why they weren't injured or anything. And then the day following, I remember driving around with them, driving around town, and seeing this you know, destruction firsthand. So I guess that made a very vivid impression on me. And I've always been fascinated with weather. My husband for a time did weather on the ABC affiliate in Dallas, and so he was always talking about weather, and he's still very fascinated with weather. So I guess it's just, you know, in a way, in my bloodstream, so to speak, and it was interesting to me. But so I took something that was more or less familiar and just created a story around it.
Yeah, you did, and a really interesting story that we're not going to tell too much about. We're just going to, you know, give them a touch about some of the characters in the story, because there are a lot of plot twists in this one, and they won't get.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I'm glad that I mean, I build them in, and then sometimes they show up even as a surprise to me. I'll be going along thinking, wow, I know everything that's going to happen. And then a character will do something that, or something will occur that even I didn't see coming. And that's when I know I'm on to something pretty good. It's when it surprises even me.
Well, I'll tell you, when they read this whole thing through, and I'm not going to say too much, because we're going to talk about Bellamy in a couple of seconds. The plot twists are really amazing. And the ending, yeah, they're not going to get it. Trust me.
Well,
and I'm good. And I won't tell you if I got it, but I go like, oh, okay, because that's why I asked if you were going to do another one, because I really like this character. So tell us something about Bellamy, and why does she not like storms?
Yeah, Bellamy is the main character, and the story begins 18 years after the tornado struck. When she was 12 years old, she was at a family company picnic, and during the tornado, her sister, who was a couple of years older, became one of the casualties, and it was later discovered that her sister had indeed been murdered and was not killed by the storm. The reader knows that in the first few pages, so I'm not giving anything away.
I wasn't going to ask that question.
she writes a novelization of the true story, but she publishes it under a pseudonym because she wants to kind of protect the privacy of her family. This, of course, was such a pivotal, life-changing event in their lives, and each family member, you know, has dealt with it in his or her own way, but it was a tragedy from which none of them ever truly recovered. And so Bellamy, kind of as a cathartic exercise, writes this novel based on fact, and it's discovered that it was indeed based on, you know, her family history and wasn't entirely fiction. And that's when things really start to turn bad for her, because someone for 18 years has gotten away with the murder, and the murderer is a little upset that the crime has once again been brought forth to the public's attention. And, of course, Bellamy is living the life I wish I had. Her book becomes this fabulous bestseller. It becomes, you know, fodder for Hollywood. Everybody's scrambling to make the movie, and actors are vying for, you know, the plum parts and everything, and she's doing this media tour and is on all the national talk shows and everything. It's a novelist's dream, but she's very reluctant to have all this publicity, because she really didn't write the book. She wanted it to be well-read and well-received, but she wanted to remain anonymous, so she had used a pen name. Now, all of a sudden, you know, she's in the media spotlight, and it's a very uncomfortable position for her, especially when things start going bad and she realizes that whoever killed her sister now wants her to shut up.
Well, they were would like to shut her up, but you know what can I say?
Yeah, and if she doesn't shut up voluntarily, yeah, the killer is wanting to do that.
Yeah, well, we won't tell anybody that because they're not going to figure it out.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
Trust me, they're not. You know, the rest of us maybe, but the rest, no. So she gives the book to someone. She's going to see her father, and she gives the book to Dent Carter. How come she gives it to him? Why does she?
Dent,
he's angry.
Dent
he's not a happy person.
Dent was her. He's the hero of the piece, although he's kind of an anti-hero. He's not typical in that. Mm-hmm. He's kind of a selfish character. He looks after himself. He's got his own difficulties, which I don't want to go into. But he was her sister's boyfriend at the time of her death. And it was because of their involvement and some suspicion being cast on him, he doesn't welcome her book becoming a bestseller and this media frenzy either, because it also casts new light on him, which he would much, much rather have been avoided. And but in the long run, he thinks the only way they're going to get through this is that if they figure out just what happened and what's going on, and that's the only way that he'll be able to finally clear his name once and for all, and to the satisfaction of everyone. And so together, they start trying to reconstruct the series of events that took place that day.
Yeah, and all we're going to tell everybody is that the name of her sister is Susan, and that's it.
Yeah, Susan. Yeah.
She was not
a very nice person, actually.
No, she really wasn't a very nice person, was she?
So there were a lot of people who had motive to kill her.
A whole litany of people that would like to kill her. And that's all we're going to say about her. Now Bellamy goes to see her father. But what was wrong with her father that she went to see him?
Well, I'm not going to tell that.
We can't say that. Okay, so, and he's married to Olivia, and that's all we'll say about that.
Yeah, Olivia and her father have a very close marriage, and Olivia is her stepmother, and she had combined the families, the two sisters, and then Olivia comes into the marriage with Stephen, who becomes their stepbrother. And they, from the outside, it appeared that, you know, they had a wonderful family. They were wealthy. They owned a software business in Austin, Texas, by the way, where the book takes place. And so from the outside looking in, they represented the all-American family. So this tragedy that struck them was particularly bothersome to people because, you know, when people who appear to have everything, when something like this happens to them, they either feel very, very sorry for them, or they feel like, well, they share the same kinds of problems and difficulties as the rest of us, you know. her father's a very noble character, and she, Bellamy, loves him dearly. He's really one of the underpinnings of her life and means a great deal to her, and she respects him. And I think that a lot of her character of fortitude, integrity, all of that, I think, came from him. And so having lost her mother at a very early age, she's very, very close to him, and he means a great deal to her.
We think we're having, I'm not sure, we're having some kind of problem with some of the other authors. I don't know. If you're having problem hearing the sound, maybe you need to refresh your pages. I'm not sure. I don't have any problems hearing you, and thank goodness you don't have trouble hearing me, but sometimes that happens. Okay. There's another character that we can talk about a drop. someone that was close to Dan was Gall Hathaway.
Oh, yeah. I love Gall.
I love him, too.
He was so fun to write. Yeah. He's kind of the, if you're familiar with the Hero's Journey, the book about screenwriting and book writing and how myths all kind of have, you know, standard characters. And in Dent's life, Gall would represent the mentor. He's kind of like the conscience. He has, because as I say, Dent is kind of an anti-hero. He's bitter, selfish, self-interested, and I make him sound very unattractive, and really he's not at all because he's had his hard knocks. So there are reasons that he's this way, which become evident in the story as the story unfolds. But and he does become a very sympathetic character. But at the beginning, he's kind of got a huge chip on his shoulder, and Gall seems to be the only one that he allows to knock it off every now and then. And I loved their kind of bantering provided, I think, some comic relief. But also, he said to Dent what Dent already knew. He just needed to hear. And Gall never backed down from pointing out Dent's shortcomings to him, and also providing, as I say, kind of a conscience, a kind of what the hell do you think you're doing kind of thing. And so I really loved writing those scenes with them. I enjoyed Gall a great deal. He's also just kind of a colorful character, you know, his pattern of speech and I really had fun with him. Sometimes those secondary characters are the most fun to write because you don't really have to know their psychology the way that you know the hero and the heroine and even the villain. With those pivotal characters, those central characters, you kind of have to dig into their psyches and you have to know everything that makes them tick. And that also, in a way, it can be restricting. It can be shackling because you have to stay true to that. With a secondary character like Gall, who appears when you need him and when you need, you know, the conscience to come into play, he doesn't really have to have that great of a background, you know, or he really doesn't have to have the underpinnings that you have to give the central characters. He can just come out and say what he wants to, you know, and you don't have to explain why he feels that way. So in a way, it's a lot of fun, and it's liberating to be able to write those kinds of secondary characters. You have more freedom.
Yeah, he sort of told you what he wanted. I like him because he's straightforward. He's sort of like
outspoken. Oh, yeah, he shoots from the hip.
Kind of person.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's the kind of person I like. Well, they tell me that I'm like that, too, so that's even better. So he sort of, you know, says it all.
You could relate then.
Yeah, I seriously can relate. Yeah, I read another book like that yesterday by Eileen Thornton, Divorcee's Biz, and the main character, Sadie, was straightforward, told it how it was, and I said, definitely you wrote me in the book, because that's just the way it is. I think Sadie and Gall would go great together. I don't know who would get the last word, but yeah, you sometimes, like you said, the characters sort of rate themselves, and he sort of stood out, even though he was a secondary character, and he sort of put Dent, you know, where he sort of centered him.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Would Bell
a good way of putting it. Yeah, good way of putting it. He centered him.
Because any time that I felt that he felt he was getting a losing track, he would go to him. But didn't he was the person that owned the airlines, that, you know, the plane, the private plane company that he ran, that he worked in, right?
Well, Dent owned his own plane. He ran the Gall runs the kind of the little airport, the private airport where they fly out of, yeah.
Okay, so would Bellamy change anything she did, or would she still want everyone to read her own story, even though the outcome is whatever that is?
Okay, I'm not sure I got that question.
If Bellamy, knowing that, you know, what happened, Bellamy, do you think she would have written, knowing the outcome of the whole story, do you think Bellamy was sorry that she wrote the novel?
Well, initially, she certainly had some reservations about the publicity that it generated, and she was apologetic to her parents and to her brother, and even in some regard to Dent for kind of opening up this can of worms. But in the long run, I think she felt as though it were essential. And I think that she would never have been able to go on with her life had she not kind of expunged this haunting event in her life. And at one point, I believe she even tells Dent, you know, she said, this has been the epicenter of my life for 18 years, because she was only 12 when the event occurred, when the murder occurred. Mm-hmm. And so her whole adulthood has been spent trying to cope with this, trying to grapple with this, trying to find answers. And so I think that when all was said and done, I don't think she would have ever gone back and undone it, no. It had tragic consequences, but that was also sort of necessary. And it was just, I mean, in the end of the book, it was moral and it was just. And so sometimes painful experiences have to occur before, you know, justice can be had. So I think she... Even in hindsight, she would have said, had we asked her this question, I think she would have said no, even though there were aspects of it that were dreadfully painful for me and the people that I loved, it still had to come to light.
Do you think she would have still written it under a pseudonym if she knew what happened, or would she just say, it's me, I wrote it?
I think she might have gone the pseudonym route. If she could have had a choice, she would have remained anonymous.
Remained anonymous.
But that was at the first of the book. At the end of Low Pressure, she might have changed her mind about that.
Mm. Yeah, maybe. You never know. Okay, I'm going to only ask, because I'll drop about this person, because we don't want to give it any more away. Who is Steven?
That's her brother.
That's okay. We can say that.
Her stepbrother.
That's her brother. Yeah, we're not going to say anything else about him, because then that would not be good. Okay. When you decided to write this novel, how did you decide on the plot or storyline? So, did you map out the chapters, or do you use an outline, or did you decide like the ending first and then the beginning?
Well, with each book, it's different. With Low Pressure, I think I've touched on how the initial idea came about. Typically, I get an idea, in this case, what would happen if after the casualties of a tornado, it's determined that one was a murder and not an accident. That what if, and then go from there. And I play with it until... I take different avenues and see which one leads to something or which one comes up against a brick wall. And after working with it for a while, hopefully a plot will reveal itself. I always feel like the story's there. It's not that I'm so much creating a story as excavating it. I feel like the story is always there. It may take me a while or I may never find it. But I love that aha moment when all of the pieces come together And I know that the idea has become a story. And not all ideas do. But I know that moment when everything opens up and I've found that one element, that one thread that is going to pull the idea into a story. And it's a great feeling. Then I can sit down and start building in all of those surprises and everything. So typically, I know the main problem, the terrible trouble that the protagonist is going to get into as soon as possible. Ideally, the first sentence, but definitely the first page or so. And then I know how it's going to end. So I know where I'm going to start and I know where I'm going. I don't always know how I'm going to get there.
In the middle.
And so for me, an answer to your question, no, I don't always do an in-depth outline. Because the fun of it, of being a storyteller, is to reveal the story as it goes along. And if I know everything, then what would be the point of telling it? So I kind of put the characters in place. This is the terrible trouble you're in. Now dazzle me with your brilliance. How are you going to get out of it? And so I kind of know where they're going to go, but I don't always know how they're going to get there. And I let them kind of feel their way and build in a few, you know, pitfalls along the way. And then, as I said, sometimes the pitfalls surprise me. And that's really fun when I'm going along thinking I know everything, and then all of a sudden a character will do something or an event will occur that I didn't see coming, and I go, oh, wow, that is great, you know. So sometimes the best surprises I've had in a book is one that wasn't even in the original idea. So it's kind of weird how that happens, but it's a great feeling. So I don't work from an outline. Typically, once I have the plot more or less in place and I have the highlights, I send a synopsis to my editor, and she reads it and gives me her feedback, and we talk about it, and then I rarely look at it again. I start my book and then let the story unfold itself.
I have a question from the chat room.
Mm-hmm.
This is a really interesting question. The question is from Karen Vaughn. She would like to know if your ideas come from personal experiences, or do you borrow any of them or use something out of the headlines?
Well, if I had lived everything that my characters have lived, I would have been dead a long time ago. And truly, my life is not nearly as exciting as my books, nor am I as brave or clever as my heroes and heroines. So are they based on personal experience? No. I have had a few things that came out of, you know, things that have occurred in my life, but generally speaking, no, nor do I write about anybody that I know about in particular. But I think that everything an author experiences in one way or another kind of shows up in a book, but not necessarily in the same way. Where the ideas come from, in the case of Low Pressure, it was from, you know, just seeing all the storms last year. And I did experience a tornado when I was a child. And in Texas, you know, they're an ever-present danger. That kind of came out of all the storms that occurred last year and the devastation that they wreaked. And so that's where I got the initial idea. But sometimes an idea, I have absolutely no idea where it comes from. I have no clue. It'll just be there all of a sudden. Often it will come from a character. I will think, now that'd be somebody interesting to write about. What kind of story can I give that individual? And And sometimes it's a topic or a controversy that happens to be in the news. I have read little snippets in the newspaper, you know, those little fillers that are like two paragraphs long. And it's more like a tease. You don't get the full story. And I'm going, well, wait a minute. You know, what happened after that? And yeah. So I might put a different spin on something like that. So it's really, to Karen, I would say, it's really difficult to pinpoint where ideas come from, because the bottom line is I really rarely know.
Well, when you create your novel, and this one has a lot of plot twists and suspense,
mm-hmm.
how do you create your plot twists and suspense? Now, in this particular book, does Bellamy telling you, you know, okay, at this point you're going to fool the reader, or is it something that just happens, the suspense? Because suspense in a novel, this is a mystery, this is a thriller, right? This is considered a thriller, so everybody's waiting for something to happen, not just to solve the murder, but it's even better than that. So how do you take that place in the middle of the story to keep readers, you know, sticking, like myself? I couldn't put the book down once I started it. Forget it.
Well, I think you want to take your reader by the hand and lead them down a certain path. But if you've done your job, they'll be going along thinking they've got it, and then something will happen that is, you know, that makes sense. But it's going to be a reversal. It's going to be not at all what they expected, and that comes with years and years of practice. and I still, to this day, I have to work really, really hard at it. You want your reader to be surprised, but you also have to be fair. In other words, you know, you can't have a missing child and it turns out to be the alien ship. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It has to be something that was there all the time. They just didn't see it. When I get to page 250 and I think, okay, this is getting boring, something's got to happen, I start looking at the characters. You always want your main characters, your protagonist, to be at cross purposes with your antagonist. What is it that the protagonist wants that the antagonist is trying to keep them or prevent them from getting?
Mm.
Or what is it that the protagonist is trying desperately to stop the antagonist from doing? So they've got to be at cross purposes. So when I'm kind of sailing along and there hasn't been a reversal or a plot twist for a while, I go to start looking at the characters, and I say, okay, what would this character do in this situation? What would this character do? What would this character do? And usually you find the twist within the character's motivations. That's where I typically start looking when I need for something, you know, to happen. Also, you can reveal something that you've kept a secret. And this is a real elemental thing about suspense writing. You plant questions in the reader's mind, constantly plant questions in the reader's mind. You say something that they're going like, now what? And then you don't answer that question for pages and pages and pages. So they're in their mind, subconsciously, they're thinking, what was that about the so-and-so? We still don't know what happened. I still don't know what happened there. And they're going to keep reading to find out what happened. And the kind of rule of thumb that I use is you're going to constantly keep asking questions and withholding the answers. But the first question you ask should be at the beginning of the book, and it should be the last question you answer at the end of the book. So the first question asked is the last one answered. And that maintains the suspense throughout the book. And it's a subliminal thing. I mean, you don't literally put a question mark at the end of the line, but but you plant that question, that seed of doubt, that and you build it into the prologue or into chapter one. There's something that the reader wants to know from that point forward, and you withhold the answer to that until the very end. That's what maintains the suspense.
Well, this book's got plenty of it, and just that question from the beginning, which I won't tell anybody what it is, and the answer at the end and in the middle, they're not going to get it. because the suspense and the hidden twist at the end was really like, I said, oh, really? How very interesting. And then the final ending was real. This is one of the best, I have to tell you. It was amazing.
Well,
so
thank you.
When you write a prologue, I'm adding this question in because it's not really a plot point. I have a piece of paper here that I can't even read what I wrote anymore because as you're speaking, I'm writing. When authors write a prologue, sometimes, not in your case, but sometimes they write the prologue and then you wonder at the end, how does it fit into the end of the story or why did they put it there? What is the purpose of a prologue and how does it work within the story, low pressure?
Well, sometimes I've written them and sometimes I haven't. It just depends on how I structure the story. But I think what the prologue should do here again is plant the seed of doubt, plant the first question, and then just hang on to it, keep that reader guessing. How does this tie in? And eventually you're going to reveal that answer, but at the same time you want to hold it off for as long as you can. And the instance of low pressure, it kind of sets the tone for the whole thing. And I think it's a great sentence. The rat was dead, but no less horrifying than if it had been alive. Mm. Well, who's going to read that and not want to go, well, what dead rat?
Exactly.
And what does the dead rat represent? And so, but sometimes I've written a prologue, and so sometimes I just start with a chapter one. It just depends how the story. The book I'm writing now, which is called Deadline, I've got a 7-page prologue. Now, in the case of low pressure, the prologue is in present day, and chapter one picks up, with present day, so there's not that much time lapse. But in the prologue to Deadline, it takes place almost 40 years before the story opens. But there's a reason for that. So I have something happens in the prologue that's the first question asked. And it's the last question I answer in the book. So,
well, I just want everybody to know that there are a whole bunch more characters in the book, and that's all I'll say. And we're not going to tell you who they are, but yeah, there's a whole bunch more characters, so that when you read the book, you'll understand what's in the middle, how she created the twist, and how she created the suspense. And that's all I'll say about that, because even when I wrote my review, which I haven't posted on Amazon yet, because I waited. When did the book come out? Because it just came out, right?
September. Yeah.
September.
Just this month came out in trade paperback, but it came out in hardcover in September.
Well, they sent me a paperback, yes, and I was under the impression, because the publicist said that it was first coming out in February, so here I am.
Yeah, well, that was the trade paperback, but the hardcover issue came out in September.
I'll have to be more alert here. So when is deadline coming out?
Deadline will be out September this year. Oh, dear, my doorbell's ringing. Has this ever happened to anybody?
Oh, gosh.
Hold on.
Do you want to take a break?
Okay,
hold on just one sec. Not a problem. Okay, if anybody has a question in the chat room, Sandra Brown says hello, and she'll be back in just a moment. For those of you that haven't
read, I just
read
got Valentine roses.
Oh, my goodness, that is so great. Happy Valentine's Day,
everybody. Well, thank you. I'm sorry to put you on hold, but I'm afraid.
That's a good reason.
Absolutely, and they're gorgeous. Pretty red roses.
Oh, that's nice. My husband's inside. Maybe we should send him a text and a picture. No, actually, we're going to, because I was doing the show today, he promised me a shopping spree tomorrow, at least 1 hour, to go shopping to buy myself something for Valentine's Day today, which is how I prefer it. It's so much better when you buy your own presents and you get what you want. But that's so nice. Did you read the card? Did I get knocked off? Hello?
No, you're still on, Franny.
Yeah. Is Sandra there? Did she get knocked off?
Yes. Yes, she got knocked off. Hopefully she'll call back.
I hope she called back. Yeah. Because I thought it was just me. Yeah. Okay, I have her phone number if you want to call her back.
You don't want to give her just a second?
I'll give her a second, yeah. Okay, while we're waiting, let me tell everybody that next Wednesday I'm going to be interviewing Dr. Marina Gascu, a doctor at the Mayo Clinic, who wrote a book called A World to Asunder, and it tells about her grandfather that was a prisoner in a Romanian prison camp. It was excellent. I'm also going to be interviewing Michael Murphy. Goodbye, Emily.
Hello.
Hi, Sandra.
Yes.
Hi, you got knocked off. I thought I got knocked off. This is what happens with Blog Talk. Okay, are we here? We're back again?
We're back.
Oh, okay, good. That's my show for next Wednesday at 3. And next Thursday at 4, I have Michael Palmer. And at 5, James Grippando. I am totally excited. Political suicide and blood money. And here we are. Sandra, I have a couple more questions. Did you read the card from the roses?
I sure did.
Oh, I hope it was somebody good.
They're from my wonderful husband, yeah. So that's very sweet.
Oh, that is good. I really think we should, you know, take a picture and text them to my husband so he could see what other people get. No. And if I'm lucky, I'll get tomorrow. That's okay. Anyway, that's great. See, somebody's considerate, and it's Valentine's Day, and that's a happy day.
Yes,
so,
it really is. And they're gorgeous, too. Beautiful.
Oh, nice. So Deadline, I take it, is about the newspaper industry?
Well, actually, my hero writes for a news magazine. He's a journalist. Mm-hmm. He writes for a Time magazine,
mm-hmm.
Or Newsweek or something like that. And he's just recently back from covering the war in Afghanistan. He stayed over there for 9 months. And he becomes involved in this story that takes place in Savannah, Georgia. And it's... And so deadline has kind of a double meaning, but yeah. So
yeah, giveaway. I just hope that I hope Caitlin remembers to send me a copy.
Oh, I'm sure she will. sure she
well,
will.
I will email her and remind her so that we could set up another interview.
Absolutely. I hear you're having Michael Palmer. He's a great guy, too. Really, really sweet.
Yeah, I'm
going to
have Michael Palmer. We're going to talk about political suicide next Thursday, and then we're going to have, like, an intermission in between. And we're going to have James Grappando at 5 o'clock, Blood Money. I am really so lucky because this is so much fun, and it's great. And then the week after, we're going to have Dr. Mark Rubenstein, who's a forensic psychologist. Before I forget, and I don't want to forget, please join Marcia Casper-Cook and Virginia Grenier, who are the World of Ink, the network that I'm on, for a special edition tomorrow, February 15th at 1 p.m. Eastern, 11 Mountain, and 10 a.m. Pacific. And their special guest will be Linda Lee Green. And Linda Lee Green's book is outstanding because Fran read it. And I definitely reviewed it. It's excellent. You're going to love it. It's going to be a great show. So that's this week. That's tomorrow. And I have a few more questions. Okay. So we know the deadline is next, and it's going to be in September. So what message, when you, after reading Low Pressure, would Bellamy want to change? Would Bellamy want to change anything about the novel? Would she want you to add or detract or say or change anything in the plot, or do you think she's happy with it the way it is?
Bellamy in her novel, you mean?
In her novel, in Mopus,
yeah.
In her novel.
Oh, I don't think so. She might want to do an epilogue. reprints, she might want to have a foreword or something that says the ending is a little different in real life, but can't address too much about that, or we're going to give away the plot of My Low Pressure. But she might want to have to print a little bit of a retraction in hers and make it an epilogue or an afterword, I guess you would call it. Yeah.
But I think that she would write it again. If she had a choice, do you think she's going to write some more novels?
Oh yeah, I think I'll leave that with the reader that she would pursue that. And from now on, I think she even tells Dent she's not going to make any more autobiographical. But I think she definitely enjoyed the exercise of writing and that's what she wants to do.
Well, we were talking before the show, and I'm sure readers would, you know, listeners would like to know, do you have a specific serial character, or do you like starting, you know, with a different character in every single book?
No, I like to start afresh with each book. I have never really been interested in writing a series based on one character or a group of characters, and I don't know why specifically, except that I think I would maybe grow bored with it. And I so admire my colleagues who are able to do that and keep the material fresh and keep the stories fresh. It's a talent that I'm afraid I just wouldn't have. When I close a story, I'm ready to go on with a new set of characters and start again. I did I've done a couple of sequential books. I did a trilogy set in Texas years ago. They were more romances. And I carried over characters from one book to another, sometimes a secondary character from one book to another. And most recently, that was about 3 years ago when I wrote Smash Cut. And there was a character in there that I just loved so much that I felt like he deserved his own story. So I wrote Tough Customer for him. But largely, I like to leave that set of characters and move on.
Would you take any, I'm just thinking of this as I'm listening, would you ever take any of the main characters from a few of the books and bring them together in another novel, or maybe even give Gaul his own book?
I don't think Gaul would hold up as a whole book. I loved the character that he was.
Yeah.
He was so much fun to write. But there are very special aspects that make a protagonist. And I think that with the case of Dodge, the character in Tough Customer, he walked into the scene of Smash Cut, and he wasn't even in my proposal. I mean, I didn't even have him written in the synopsis that I sent to my editor. And he just walked into the scene, and I immediately went, whoa, who is this? He had an essence about him that I just was immediately attracted to. And the more that I wrote him into Smash Cut, the more intrigued I became by his cynicism. That was the main element of his personality that interested me. And I thought, what would make a man his age, he's 60-ish, what would make him that cynical and jaded and mistrustful and down on life, you know, just and yet have his own charm? And so that's what really interested me about him, and I thought I would pursue it, dig a little deeper, and then I discovered I know this all sounds like I'm crazy, but I discovered in his background that there was a pivotal event that had changed his life forever, and he made a dreadful, dreadful error in judgment, a mistake that he's been paying for ever since. And so that gave me a story. So I don't think that you can just pick a character nilly-willy and say, yeah, I'll build a story around them. I think there has to be something about them that so intrigues you that you want to dig further.
Well, when you send it, this is a question that a lot of the authors have asked before. The hardest thing is to make sure that a book is properly edited. And not just grammar mistakes, but content and story and pacing and things like that.
Absolutely.
This is something that I've started to do for authors where, you know, on an unpublished manuscript, I'll read it and I'll critique it. And I'll just say, you know, maybe the storyline needs this or the characters need that. And they can either listen to what I'm saying or not. You know, it's just a matter of my opinion. And for some reason, it seems to be right. When you send it to the editor, your editor, does the editor give you plot line suggestions too and content line, or is it just for grammar and structure and structure?
Well,
structural
no, my editor might cite problems, but the way that I like to work is if the editor cites a problem with something, I've told her and I've told every editor I've ever worked with, bring the problem to my attention, but don't solve it for me.
Gotcha.
Because I have to solve it. I'm very, very, very particular that every single word, be it good, terrible, or mediocre, has to be mine. And so if, for instance, you know, a note might be, I didn't get a sense of this character's or this scene, I felt like so-and-so didn't quite get their point across, and I know what you were going for, but I think you need to work on it for clarity or something like that. That would be like a typical note that I would get. And then I'd go look at the scene, and I'd say, you know, they're right. She's right. I didn't quite make it clear enough. So, but in other words, I would have to be the one to solve the problem. So I appreciate an editor giving me input and giving me a note, because they're your first reader. You'd be crazy not to take their advice, at least consider it, because they're the first reader and they represent the thousands that are kind of going to come later. Mm. So if the editor says, I didn't quite get this, mm-hmm. then that is a pretty good indicator that a lot of other people won't either. So there are very few times when I've adamantly disagreed with a note, because I'd say, you know, you're right, but here's what I was trying to do. I just didn't do it well enough, so let me work on it. But it has to be my solution.
I don't blame you.
I wouldn't ask or actually entrust my editor to do my work for me.
Well, that makes it your book. That's right. And then, you know, they
that's
can always
right.
change what the book says. They could change the plot line and it won't come out the way you intended it to be. And then the ending or the twist won't be
Well,
there.
I would never work with an editor who would do that anyway. So.
Yeah, there are a lot that do, and there are a lot that argue and say, well, you know, this doesn't make sense, that doesn't make sense. So yeah, okay, I'll fix it. I know I've worked with a few myself, but they're not quite as forthcoming as the ones that you get to work with. Mm-hmm. And how many edits do you go through? Because that's the other thing. Do you have more than one person that reads the book, or just one editor that
reads it?
The plot line?
Just one. Yeah, now I think that she has other people read it because she gets their input too, but I just work with one. And then of course, they're always given over to copy editors for final proofreading, but that's just line editing. Or the proofreader may come across a question, you know, a query, saying, is this a Southern expression? I don't know what something means. Or... I thought this character had on such and such page. You said blue eyes. Now they're green, or something like that. You know, but that would be all.
Oh, like an inconsistency thing.
Yeah. Here again,
you want
them to, and they usually flag the manuscript, the copy edited manuscript. And sometimes, if there are several queries, I'll get it back. Sometimes they'll just say, we'll just put it in the galley, just put a query and you can change it then. So,
yeah, I know, because I've read so many, manuscripts from before, and I've said, gee, sometimes it's even as simple as writing the wrong character on a line and they didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And that could kill the whole plot of a story where the character's name is Betty and all of a sudden they write Bonnie. And I've had just one book where they spelt the character's name three different ways. And I thought I realized it was the same person, but I said, but somebody else is going to think it's just three different people with the same name. So that's the other thing, because you don't want a book with grammar mistakes and you don't want a book with typos in it. And, after reading and reviewing over 900 books in the last 2.5 years, and that's all I've been doing, is people.
Mm.
You do find them, and it happens, and it's very upsetting because reviewers have a tendency to sometimes flag that in a review, which I find I don't do when I review something,
mm-hmm.
because not everything's going to be perfect. So before we go, what basis do you place on reviews? Does it really matter? A 5-star review, a 3-star review? How do you handle that?
Oh, well, I think every review is important. It's the reaction of a reader, but you also can't let it. You can't get too bubbly and effervescent over a fantastic one, mm-hmm. even any more than you can just become completely disconsolate mm-hmm. over one that's not so great.
Uh-huh.
I try to soothe myself with the thought that I've been doing this for 32 years,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not going to please everyone all the time, but I would not have lasted 32 years in the industry had I not been doing something that a lot of people still kind of liked. So it's, I can get really, kind of, oh, gee, wish that person hadn't said that, because that's kind of bad. but then somebody else does something wonderful. So it's a balancing thing. And typically, you know, I please myself first, and I'm a really harsh critic of my own work. So, I take the reviews to heart, but I don't let them change me too much. You know, if somebody says every book of hers is just such and such or so and so, then I'm thinking, then why are you reading them?
Yeah,
if every single book, if you're finding a problem with it, why are you read somebody else? You know, so I listen, I take them to heart. I love the ones that are great, and the ones that aren't so great, I'm like, didn't make that person happy. But I keep, as I say, longevity is a pretty good indicator that something I've done has made a lot of readers all over the world happy with their choice, you know. So that's the best I can do and the best I can say about it.
I would think so. But, you know, I've read reviews on Amazon. I don't read a review. When I review a book, I review it, then I post my review. And then I might read what other people write after I post mine. And I've noticed a lot that you can't take to heart the negative reviews, because sometimes it's just somebody that just wants to see their name in print and they didn't even read the book.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell when somebody gets what the author is saying and the message, and then you can tell when somebody says, this author writes the same thing all the time, this book is about Bellamy and I don't know what the rest of it's about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can tell that when I post my review that I read the book and that I've got the message. So before we go, what message do you hope readers will come away with after reading Low Pressure, besides the fact that they should all go on Amazon and buy 20 copies of it?
Right, absolutely. That sounds like a great idea to me.
Yeah, and Easter's coming up, and Passover's coming up, and, you know, people like presents. And I can't think of a better present than reading a book, you know, by Sandra Brown.
Oh, thank you very much. It's what I try to do with each and every book is to entertain my reader.
Mm.
And that's the only reason I'm writing fiction. If I wanted to, you know, send somebody a message, then I would probably be writing nonfiction. But my goal has always been to entertain my reader the way that I'm entertained when I'm reading a book. If I give them a little bit of departure from their ordinary world, if I transport them for a little time into mm-hmm. someone else's life, into someone else's world, then I've done my job. If I've made them feel a visceral, emotional reaction to what's happening on the page, then I've done my job. If I've introduced them to a character that they feel empathetic toward, if they're afraid of, if they fall in love with, if they find repugnant, whatever it is, I've done my job. I've created a person, an individual that they feel as though they know in one way or another. And so when I'm reading a book, I want to get to know the character. I want to get to know the place, the setting. I want to feel involved, draw them. I want to be drawn into that world for a little while. If I've done that for my reader, I've done my job and I can sleep that night. So that's what I try to do. I don't aspire to do anything else except to give my reader a few hours of entertainment.
That is great, because you're exactly right. Because when you're reading a book, you want to be carried away somewhere. You don't want to look at your watch and say, when is this going to be over?
Right. That's right.
And you know,
I usually look at the pages of a book I'm enjoying and going, oh, it's going to be over soon. I don't want it to end.
It's when you turn to the last page, like I did in Low Pressure, or you turn to the last page of a book and say, oh, I wish he would have written 10 more chapters.
Then
you know that it's great. But then, you know, you get a book, and I've read a few that are like 800, 900 pages, And I'm saying to myself, this author could have said the same thing in 450 or 350 pages. Yeah, because and they've repeated scenes and they've repeated incidents and they've repeated characters. And as a reviewer, you know, you don't want to say, oh, my God, I wish you would have made the book shorter. But you've got to somehow say the book is not five stars, it's really four. And, I at this point, too long is too long. A Sandra Brown book is never too long, people.
Well, thank you for that.
If everybody wants to find you besides on Amazon, and where can they learn more about you, and where can they get your books?
SandraBrown.net gives you just about everything you want to know. We've just revamped our website. Went up about a month ago with a new look, and it's more user-friendly. There are links to Barnes & Noble, Amazon. You can buy, the book from a link off the website. So anything, it's a pretty comprehensive website, and as I say, we've just made it more user-friendly. So just about anything you want to know about me, the entire bibliography is on there. Their frequently asked questions are on there. So that would be the best thing, SandraBrown.net or SandraBrown.com.
That is so great. I appreciate the fact that you did this. I am
well,
so
thank
glad
you.
To have
it was
you
my
on
pleasure.
My Oh, I am so excited. I am going to email Caitlin and thank her. She worked really hard to get me not to ask the wrong questions here. And I think I did fine by not giving away the plot. It's hard sometimes. I came up with like 40 questions, and I realized that they were a little bit too in-depth, but I wanted everybody to know that Fran read the book. Actually read the book.
I don't think anybody has a question about that. And the questions were very good. And
thank you. And
we got to talk about writing without being too specific about this particular book. So that's good.
That's even better.
You certainly whetted their interest. I think you certainly whetted the interest.
Yes, I know.
Haven't read it.
Karen is dying for the book too, but in order to get the book, I had to answer the right questions for Caitlin to make sure that I really, am a reviewer. But I told Karen just put it on her wish list too. So I know she's going to read it and review it. For those of you that don't know, I run a site called Reviewing Your Book on Facebook. Sandra's review is on there. The link to the show, if anybody didn't hear the whole show, it's there. It's live on demand, iPod, podcast, etc. And I am so glad that you came on the show. I really appreciate it, and I hope that I can schedule another interview with you in September when Deadline comes out.
I would love that. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sandra. And anybody that doesn't go out and buy Low Pressure and every one of her books, I don't know what's wrong with you.
Well, thank you. Happy Valentine's Day.
Happy Valentine's Day, and tell your husband that is really great with the roses.
Okay, I will. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, for those of you, just to remind you that Marcia Casper Cook's show with Virginia Grenier is on tomorrow at 1 o'clock, and she will have Linda Green, and Linda's book is absolutely fantastic because Fran did read it and review it. Next Wednesday, we're going to have a show on Alzheimer's. Michael Murphy's book is Goodbye, Emily, and it deals with Woodstock and two guys that break their friend out of a nursing home before he dies from Alzheimer's. And I'm going to be talking about my book, Memories Are Precious, and we're going to do, I'm going to put the link to the Ruth Swerdloff Clinical Foundation at Montefiore. So for anybody that wants to help find the cause of Alzheimer's, I'm going to put that on next week also. On Thursday, Michael Palmer, Political Suicide, James Grappando, Blood Money. And the following week, Mad Dog House, Dr. Mark Rubenstein, and David Daricott will be on because we had to reschedule him as to what happened on the show last time. So he's going to come back and just talk about internal security. And on that note, we will be back next week. Bethany, thank you so much. Karen, thank you so much for being here. And I will see everybody next Wednesday at 3:00. Have a nice day and bye.